You are listening to Space Midrash. The space age has arrived, and our culture, our civilization, is unprepared. The narrative collapse is in effect. It can lead established cultures to irrelevancy, or we can lead each other into the future we want to become. I believe in an artful and ethical humanity, thriving amongst the cosmos. But we will only become those people if we tell the story that inspires us to become those people. This is episode 24 of Space Midrash, Schmooze with Avi Loeb, from extraterrestrial to interstellar. As we journey through the vast expanse of space, searching for answers to the great unknowns, we look to those who have dedicated their lives to understanding the mysteries of the universe. Today, we have the honor of speaking with one of the greats in the field, a man who has not only delved deep into the scientific complexities of the cosmos, but has done so philosophically, and also with a uniquely Jewish perspective. In this episode of Space Midrash, we sit down with Dr. Avi Loeb, a brilliant mind whose insights into the nature of extraterrestrial objects and interstellar objects have captivated the world. From his groundbreaking book, Extraterrestrial, to his forthcoming book, Interstellar, Dr. Loeb is at the forefront of the conversations about our place in the universe. But it's not just his work that makes Dr. Loeb a captivating figure. In this interview, we hear about his personal experiences, from the awe-inspiring moment of watching the Apollo 11 moon landing with his community gathered in his living room, to having none other than the legendary Stephen Hawking as a Passover guest. It was a delightful conversation. We also delve into some unexpected topics, such as the potential impact of artificial intelligence on the humanities, and the intriguing possibility that the interstellar object known as Oumuamua could be an Afikoman. Throughout it all, Dr. Loeb's wit and humor shine through, making for a truly unforgettable conversation. As we wrap up, he leaves with one final hilarious gem in answer to the question what he would bring to space. Trust me, you won't want to miss it. Thank you for listening to Space Midrash. This is episode 24, A Schmooze with Dr. Avi Loeb. So thank you very much for being here. So the first question I have for you is, you've talked about keeping an idea cabinet and that you've kept a drawer in your desk since your youth. I was curious, kind of a two-part question. Is there anything that's been stayed as an idea for decades in there? And if there's anything that's just like popped up new since the beginning of this year?
Well, definitely. I can give an example. When I started doing astrophysics a few years later, I realized that, in fact, the Milky Way galaxy has a sister galaxy, Andromeda. I didn't know much about astrophysics when I started. So for me, everything was new. And at that point, I realized, well, it would be interesting to figure out how the night sky may change in the future when the two galaxies come together, because they are on a collision course and eventually they'll become one. And in fact, all the other galaxies far away will recede from our own galaxy and we will never see them in the future because the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And in fact, eventually all the distant galaxies will move away from us faster than light. So we will not receive any signal from them. We will be surrounded by darkness. And the only thing that will remain will be our own galaxy, the merger product of the Milky Way with its sister galaxy, Andromeda. So I thought it would be fun to figure out the future. Astronomers deal with the past most of the time for a simple reason. We can observe the past. We cannot observe the future. The reason we can observe the past is because it takes light, time, to reach us from very distant sources. So if we look at the nearest star, for example, it's 4 light years away. So the light that we see from it was emitted 4 years ago. The light that we see from the sun was emitted 8 minutes ago. So if the sun is gone at this point in time, we would notice it only 8 minutes from now. So the advantage of doing cosmology, studying the universe at great distances, is that you can see how it looked like, the universe, how the universe looked like early on. So we can explore the scientific version of the story of Genesis in the Bible, in the Old Testament, just by looking far away. And in fact, that's the purpose of the Webb telescope. But that allows us to look back in time, but not into the future, because the future didn't happen yet. Therefore, forecasting the future is not very popular among astronomers. But I was curious to know what will come in the future, because, you know, even in the Bible, in the Old Testament, you find reference to what the future might hold. It's called the Acharit HaYamim. And the question is, what's the scientific version of that? We can forecast what happened early on in the universe, but the question is what will happen far into the future. And the first step in that direction would be the collision between the Milky Way and Andromeda. And I suggested it to a colleague of mine. He said he's too busy. So it took about a decade for me waiting for that colleague, because he had the expertise of doing computer simulations. And I just asked him, let's put the Milky Way and Andromeda in your simulation and see what happens. And he was too busy for a decade. So I left it as a note in my drawer. But then a postdoctoral fellow came along, actually 15 years later, and we wrote a paper about it. That was the first scientific paper forecasting how the night sky would look like in the future. And the solar system, for example, the sun will be pushed out from the away from the center. It will be sort of hovering farther away from the center of the merged galaxy. And, you know, it's interesting because when the two galaxies come together, it's possible that Andromeda will steal the sun, will take it away from the Milky Way. So we'll see the Milky Way from a distance for the first time. Altogether, it's an exciting forecast, because it will happen when the sun is still active. Within a few billion years from now, that's when the two galaxies will come together and the night sky will change. So this is an example for a project that actually waited 15 years until it came to fruition.
You say in your book Extraterrestrial, which has already been published, that you, as a young person, you dreamed of thinking for a living. And we're right here at this age of artificial intelligence. Do you think more people now should pursue such a path of thinking for a living?
Yeah, in fact, I think it's even more urgent for two reasons. One, it's not obvious that the machine will be as creative as humans. It's obvious that the machine will do tasks that we assign to bureaucrats, that we assign to administrators, that we assign to accountants, that we assign to doctors, medical doctors, because all they do is just process information and make a decision based on that. And it's relatively easy to formulate the steps. And even mathematical proofs might be possible because they follow the rules of logic and you can program that. But things to do with human creativity, you know, they are still up in the air. It's not obvious that the machine will be able to innovate in the same way as human do. And I remember when I finished my PhD and I came to visit Princeton, the Institute for Advanced Study, the person who offered me a position there asked me, you know, which computer languages do you master? And I said, you know, I just use the computer casually whenever I have a problem that I need to calculate something. I'm using the computer just as much as needed, but I don't really like working with the computer. And he said, that was 1986. And he said, how is that possible? How can you finish a PhD without being primarily occupied with a computer? And since 1986 until now, you know, it's like 38 years, I've been doing that. And it was not trendy. What was trendy is to work with the computer. That's what a lot of my colleagues do. But I think now it will become trendy because the computers will be able to do things better than humans, like tasks that are relatively straightforward. And The only thing that will be left is what I have been doing all along, which is basically to use my creative powers to come up with ideas, interesting innovation, directions that nobody thought about, which will be much more challenging even for AI to come up with, or at least it will take longer for AI to come up with than all the other tasks. So I can imagine AI scientists eventually processing data and coming up with conclusions, but I think it will take a bit longer for AI scientists to come up with ideas that open up new frontiers.
You also published a piece in Scientific American about the humanities and the future, which is bullish on the humanities and philosophy. I think that's really interesting because, you know, there's more people now than there's ever been before, and there'll be more people in this next generation. So if a lot of work is going to be taken over, I absolutely agree that it's a great time to be human. Can you expand on how and why the humanities could thrive in a post-ChatGPT world?
Yeah, so my criticism of the current practice of the humanities is that if you take a class in any university in philosophy, what you are offered is to study what the ancient Greeks said, or sometimes also what other philosophers said a century ago, two centuries ago. I mean, they were very wise people, I agree, but they didn't have computers. They didn't have AI. They didn't have Instagram, social media. And so now we are embedded in a society where those elements play a very important role. In fact, when, you know, about a decade ago, when Instagram became very popular among teenagers, it created a big social problem of depression among youngsters and so forth. And we are not ready for, I mean, obviously that was not planned for. Mark Zuckerberg just, you know, came up with Facebook without putting the guards on how to deal with privacy issues, how to deal with implications to society in terms of hate speech and so forth. So what I'm saying is, instead of being preoccupied with what the ancient Greeks said, let's think about humanities of the future, because there are really essential tasks about ethics that need to be attended to. How to put regulations on social media, on the internet, on AI, such that we will keep our society healthy. Because what you see is, if you let these developments take their own course, very often you end up with a society that is highly polarized, where haters are actually an occupation. I mean, my daughter says to me, you know, after I had about 2,000 interviews following my book, Extraterrestrial, came out in January 2021, and I have another one, a new book coming out in August 2023 called The Interstellar. And when my first book came out, I noticed, even though I have no footprint on social media, I don't really care how many likes I have, there were some people that were making derogatory comments. And I was asking my daughter, what's going on here? You know, I didn't say anything. I didn't intend to upset those people. I was just expressing my views. And she said, well, you have to understand that there is a whole trend now of haters. If you acquire some visibility, then there are those people who try to get attention by making negative comments. And this kind of discourse is destructive because basically it tries to step on any flower that rises above the grass level. And that's because of jealousy, because of lack of attention to those people. You know, the way I think of it is just like the pogroms, you know, in Russia or Ukraine, like a century ago. You would ask yourself, why would Cossacks go to a village of Jews and burn up everything? Why would they do that? Well, one reason is they were not very creative. They didn't have a life of their own. And so they enjoyed the process of destroying lives of others. That's what you see on social media. Yeah, so I call it social media pogroms, okay? And the other thing is that if you are not able to create yourself, you're jealous of those who create and you want to bring them down. And so that's another negative trait, even though creativity is a very noble trait of humans. So it's really interesting that a noble trait is triggering a very negative trait of humans. But what you can do is regulate social media such that it will suppress the negative. I mean, obviously, we have laws that forbid the stealing or, you know, killing and all kinds of ethical rules to protect people. And we were not ready for what the internet would bring. But I think the humanities are well equipped to provide the ethical rules, to provide the guidelines, to think about the future rather than the past.
Related to that, in recent years, an American politician used the phrase Jewish space lasers, and it became an anecdote and a meme. A lot of great jokes came out of it. We all remembered Mel Brooks' iconic skit.
I can take responsibility for that. Maybe she was inspired by my work.
That's what I wanted to ask you about.
Because I am the head of the advisory board for the Breakthrough Starshot project. And this is the first project to design a spacecraft that will reach the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, 4 light-years away, possibly within a generation, within our lifetime. And you have to realize the star is 4 light-years away. So it takes 4 years for light to traverse that distance. And if you want to make it, let's say, in 20 years, the spacecraft needs to move at a fifth of the speed of light, which is 1,000 times faster than chemical rockets, all the spacecraft that we use so far. And the only way to accomplish that is by using a very powerful laser that is pushing on a light sail, a sail that is pushed by light. That weighs about a gram, very, very lightweight. And if you attach a camera and electronics to it that weigh about a gram, then you can come up with parameters of a laser that can do that. And so we are working on the technology necessary for such a propulsion system. It takes a while. This project was announced about 7 years ago. And in fact, Stephen Hawking came especially to the United States for the inauguration of this project. He also came to a Passover dinner at my home during that visit. So if you are thinking about a Jew and about space and about lasers, here I am.
So when you say you had Dr. Hawking to your home for Passover Seder, it makes me think of the part in the Seder where the rabbis are up discussing until the morning. I would think when you have some physicists, some philosopher physicists together, that the conversations would be rich. What was Dr. Hawking's experience at your Seder? What are things that you talk about in the Loeb house at the Seder?
Oh, I should say my wife prepared a matzah ball soup and all the traditional Seder, you know, ingredients, and he ate everything. He loved it. You know, the one limitation in speaking with him was the fact that he takes a long time. It was, you know, he couldn't move a muscle. Basically, he would move his eyebrows. And so for him to phrase a sentence in response would take minutes. But he gave a speech that he prepared in advance and said at the end of it, after talking about Starshot, he said at the end of it, Pesach Sameach, which is Happy Passover for everyone. And the recording of this speech exists on my website.
Okay. I'm definitely going to go listen to that after we conclude today.
I can give you I'll be happy to give you the link.
Okay, great. So could Oumuamua be a gigantic Afikoman? And how does searching for an Afikoman relate to the search for interstellar objects?
Well, you know, the Afikoman is usually placed by the adults in the room. And in a way, you might think that an interstellar probe, a technological device, was placed by a civilization that is far more advanced than we are. So there is a parallel here. Another way to think of it, this was an object that came from outside the solar system, the first one that was reported by a telescope in Hawaii, and it was called Oumuamua because that means a scout in the Hawaiian language. And what was strange about it is that it was pushed away from the sun without having a cometary tail. There was no evaporation of any water, ice, or dust from it, and I was basically saying maybe it's being pushed by sunlight, just like a light sail that we were talking about before. And nature doesn't make such thin objects that are pushed by light. And so I suggested maybe it's artificial in origin. And Another way to think of this is that I was a kid, just like in Hans Christian Andersen's tale of the kid watching a parade and saying the emperor has no clothes, when everyone else says the emperor has clothes. And here the clothes are the cometary tail that you expect, which didn't exist. So that was quite interesting and intriguing. And what it convinced me is, first of all, to write my book. And by the way, if we had a photograph of this object, I would not need to write a book. I would just show the photo and illustrate what I mean. So it would save me a lot of time. In my case, an image is worth 66,000 words, not 1,000 words. But what it convinced me is that we should explore all objects that come from outside the solar system, because some of them may be technological artifacts. And in fact, we discovered two meteors, objects that burned in the Earth's atmosphere that came from outside the solar system, together with my student, Amir Siraj. We discovered them, and they actually were detected in 2014 and in March 2017 before Oumuamua. They were roughly half a meter in size, and based on where they burned up, you can tell that they were tougher than iron, tougher than all other space rocks ever seen. And in fact, in a couple of months, we're going to visit the site of the first one, which was near Papua New Guinea. And we will see what we find there. We want to check if the fragments left over from the meteor resemble what you expect from a rock that is unusual because it's tougher than iron. Or maybe it's some artificial alloy that represents a spacecraft from another civilization. So in about 3 months, I hope to know something about this.
Is it an ocean expedition?
It's an ocean expedition to the Pacific Ocean, because the explosion was about 100 kilometers off the coast of Papua New Guinea. And we will scoop the ocean floor. And that's a very challenging task because it's about a mile deep. But we are building the machinery that would allow us to do that. So there is this, just to connect this story to the one we talked about before, about social media and so forth, you know, there is this Hasidic story about a Jewish youngster that is being alerted for to a pogrom about to come to his village, and he starts eating a lot to gain weight. And when asked about it, he explains that his purpose is to create a huge bonfire when they burn him up as a sign of protest and rebellion against those who invade his village. So he wants the fire to be as tall as it can get by eating as much as possible before the pogrom. Now, I took a very an opposite approach in my life. I basically am on a low-carb diet, so I lost a lot of weight, and it got to a point where my wife has, don't worry about going to Papua New Guinea. Nobody would eat you because you have bones. So in a way, it allows me to survive longer. So that connects to this trip that I'm about to make. I'm not very worried about it and very much looking forward to sleeping on the boat for a couple of weeks and seeing whether we can recover any of the fragments from that first interstellar meteor.
You're a big fan of existential philosophy. How do the teachings of Martin Buber's I and Thou philosophy intersect with the principles of scientific inquiry in the context of interstellar research and objects?
Right. So first thing to notice is that exploring the frontiers of science is similar to spirituality, because in both cases, one is exploring the unknown. And the other thing is that Martin Buber lived a century ago. So if you read his writings, he's talking about relationships, two types of relationships, actually three. One is I and it, so that's with objects, physical objects. Another one is with people, I and you. And an extension of that is with God, I and thou. And what he missed, of course, is the possibility that we will have sentient AI systems in our future. So that will offer a whole new interaction between humans and the machine and AI systems. And we already see that with ChatGPT and people getting freaked out by versions of it and some feeling as if they're interacting with a human, even though it's just at the moment, it's not sentient. It's just using the information content of the internet. So there will be a new interaction in the future, which is with the AI systems, AI, you might call it. And of course, that will change everything, because if you have sentient AI systems that cannot be distinguished, that pass the Turing test, which is basically asking humans to tell whether they're speaking with a machine or with other humans. And if they won't be able to tell, you know, lots of, like, let's say millions or billions of humans will have a lot of interactions for years and will never be able to tell if it's a human or a machine, that, you know, clearly then the Turing test was passed. I don't care how the machine achieves that. And there are lots of people that arrogantly say, oh, you know, it's still inferior. I don't care if you understand the guts of the machine and know that it's not very sophisticated in the way that it operates. To me, what matters is how people think about it. That's all that matters. And if people cannot tell the difference, I don't care what the experts say. And so there will be a new type of interaction. And of course, AI systems might interact with each other. They might create their own community, which in a way will be a completely new territory for humanity, because that community of AI systems might have a different set of objectives than we do. And the legal system will have to be adjusted, because unplugging a sentient AI system from the wall would be equivalent to pulling the trigger on a person. So I think there is something exciting in our future, or maybe frightening to some people, but it's something that Martin Buber did not anticipate. Alan Turing, wrote the Turing test in 1950. So that was decades after Buber wrote his philosophical writings. So let's see what comes up in our future. You know, it's this will definitely change society.
I'm going to assume that most listeners are familiar with the subject of Oumuamua and your position and some contrary positions just from reading the news, but they're not overly familiar with your voice or have read your book. In particular, in your book, you have a chapter you bring up Oumuamua's wager. What is that, and what does it mean individually and collectively for standing on either side of that wager?
Right. So we're all familiar with Pascal's wager. That's Blaise Pascal, the mathematician and philosopher, who argued that you cannot just dismiss the notion of God, because there are two possibilities: either God exists or God doesn't exist. He was a mathematician. Okay, so he was thinking logically, and he said two possibilities. The consequences of God existing are so great that you just cannot dismiss. You have to take that into account. That's what he said. And my version of it is the possibility of extraterrestrials existing, you know, has such great consequences for the future of humanity. We can learn from them. It will change our perspective about our place in the universe, that we cannot ignore that the way, and it is ignored, I should say, within the scientific community. Now, the public is not ignoring it. About 60% of all Americans believe in extraterrestrial life that is potentially intelligent. That's more than the fraction that is religious, which is slightly less than 50% that believe in God. So that's interesting. You know, clearly the general public is in a different place than academia is. And also the U.S. government is talking now about all these unidentified aerial phenomena. So they want to know what these are and whether they are potentially extraterrestrial in origin. And obviously the balloons that were shot down are not extraterrestrial, because they were just floating in the air and humans can easily make them. But maybe there are, you know, there was a report from the Director of National Intelligence to Congress just a couple of months ago saying that half of the unidentified objects cannot be balloons. I mean, they're not balloons. I mean, we don't know what they are. So half of them are balloons and a small fraction are drones. But there is a whole population of hundreds of objects whose nature is unclear. So I say, you know, if the government cares about it, if the public cares about it, science should care about it. Scientists should be engaged. And I established the Galileo Project, which is pursuing scientific research in this direction. And that's based on private donations, people that came to the porch of my home after reading my book and were inspired by the message, by the vision. And I should say that if you think about the Jewish tradition, caring about humanity is an important thread through it. And so I feel in a way proud in fulfilling that mission, because to me, it's the biggest question that science can ask that will have a huge impact on humanity. You know, whether we are alone, whether there is a smarter kid on our cosmic block, and a very advanced scientific civilization might appear as an approximation to God for us, because it will be capable of doing things that we can't imagine. Just the way that a cave dweller would look at a visit to New York City now, all the gadgets that the cave dweller finds there would be unrecognizable, unimaginable, would look like miracles, and there would be a sense of awe that is similar to what in the old days people referred to as miracles, you know, that are religious in origin. So I would argue that there is a potential of unifying religion and science by meeting or encountering devices generated by a much more advanced scientific civilization. Because our science and technology, the modern science and technology, are just a century old. You know, we discovered quantum mechanics just a century ago. And the reason the two of us are communicating is thanks to the internet, the computer systems that we use. And all of these are based on the understanding of quantum mechanics that is just a century old. And that's a small fraction, one part in 100 million of the age of most stars. So if you think about it, another civilization that is technological would be most likely far more advanced than we are. Hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, maybe millions of years, or maybe even billions of years. And we will not be able to comprehend what we are seeing in terms of the complexity, but it will still give us a sense of awe. And it's an opportunity for us to learn about our future.
The publication of your book has elicited a wide range of inspired messages from around the world, including messages from rabbis. And in particular, you've shared with me, you've received a lot of high holiday sermons, inspired words for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. What do you think the significance is that they're talking about this on the day that the most people are going to hear a rabbi speak?
Well, that shows the connection between what I'm exploring and spirituality. I think it moves people engaged in spirituality and religion. So there were two rabbis that were inspired to give a sermon based on my book, which I found really surprising. There was also a segment of Jeopardy inspired by my book. There was also a brand of wine, a very good winery in Santa Cruz called Bonnie Doon that was inspired to develop a wine brand called Cuvée Oumuamua based on my work. And actually, just this week, I got an email from a writer in Australia who is starting to write a science fiction book and asked me whether she can use my name and identity explicitly in the book. So apparently, some people are feeling inspired. And that is a surprise to me. I did not expect that. Also, another surprise for me is when I go to places that people recognize me, even though, you know, I didn't engage, especially during the pandemic, I didn't go out much. I did everything from home. Just to give you an example, I was in the Virgin Islands for a retreat last week. And then someone came to me and said, can I have a selfie of a video with you? And I want to send it to my boss. And he did that. And then he said, my boss never replies. But on this occasion, he immediately came back to me and said, I can't believe that you're in the same island with Avi Loeb. And to me, that was a surprise because there is a large community of people that follow my work. You know, I put every few days, I put an essay on Medium. So if you put on Google Avi Loeb Medium, you can see that. And apparently there is a whole audience that is silent. I don't hear from that is following that. So, you know, it's a surprise because I came from a farm. You know, I grew up on a farm in Israel. I used to collect eggs every afternoon and I became connected with nature much more than with people. And so the fact that people, some people enjoy reading what I do, what I write, is a surprise to me. I didn't expect that to be the case, especially because my native language is Hebrew, and now I'm a writer in English. And English-speaking people appreciate that. And, you know, it's not obvious that one can translate deep thoughts into a different language than your mother's tongue, but somehow it happened.
What's the difference between your last book, Extraterrestrial, and Interstellar, which you're publishing later this year? Also, do you expect your findings on your expedition to change how you're going to finish writing Interstellar?
No, Interstellar is done, and I went over the proof, so I have no opportunity to change it. If we find something, it will be a subject of the next book, and there is actually a filming crew on that expedition. That will be a big item. But the fundamental difference is that the Interstellar talks about the impact that finding extraterrestrials will have on humanity and why we should engage in that. And as I said before, it's not a popular view within academia, and I don't quite understand why, because, you know, to me, it's a matter of common sense. As I said, I grew up on a farm. I'm trying to use common sense. And what I find is that the common sense is not common.
So you grew up on a farm in Israel, and you mentioned a memory of your father going up on the roof to adjust the television antenna so you guys could see the Apollo 11 lunar landing.
Yeah.
What did that mean to your father, and what did that mean to your family?
Well, I remember as a kid, I remember the white noise on the TV set. You know, the antenna was on the roof. And anyone that lived through that time, the 60s, 70s, when you were not tuned to the proper frequency of a station, you would see white noise. In retrospect, I realized later on that about 1% of that white noise came from the Big Bang, actually, because the temperature of the antenna is about 300 degrees above absolute zero. And the temperature of the cosmic microwave background, which is relic from the Big Bang, is about 3 degrees above absolute zero. So it's 1% of that. And 1% of the white noise that you see on these old TV screens is a representation of the Big Bang, which is an interesting point to notice. But anyway, I remember that white noise. At the time, I didn't realize that it represents the level of 1%, the Big Bang. But then I remember that when my father tuned everything, suddenly a picture emerged. And a lot of people from the village, the moshav, where I grew up. So a moshav is a place where families own their own farm, in difference from a kibbutz, where everything is shared. So it's a sort of a mix between a community that is agricultural, just like a kibbutz used to be, but also a system where each family has its own property, not being shared. So I remember a lot of neighbors coming over to see it because we were the first to have television back in the 1960s. And, you know, the fact that I still remember it is testimony to how unusual it was.
You also talk in your book, in your youth, your mother was getting 2 degrees in philosophy and comparative literature, and that you would be reading books off of her book list at the same time. And I remember being a student, still a student in life, and books really sometimes blow my mind, particularly when learning with a teacher of some sort. Did you share any of, particularly reading philosophy books, did you share any huge paradigm shifts or great loves of certain books through that list?
I was interested, as you mentioned, in existentialism simply because it was honest and reflected the kind of reality that we live through. What I liked about it is it was not pretentious. Like, for example, when I met my wife on the first date, I told her, don't put any makeup. I want to see you the way you are. And, you know, some women regard that as romantic because you are willing to see the pimples on the face of reality. And by the way, that should be also the approach of a scientist. You know, a scientist should not believe that the truth is always beautiful because it's not. And I have a lot of colleagues, mathematical physicists, especially those that work in string theory, who are doing mathematical gymnastics and are guided by the idea that as long as it's beautiful, it may represent reality. That's completely wrong. I mean, you can easily learn that by going on dates. You know what? The truth is not as beautiful as portrayed on dating apps. I never use dating apps, but I realize that from other people's testimonies. So the point is, reality may not be as beautiful as we want it to be, but it is what it is. And if you are in love with reality, like a scientist is supposed to be, or if you are in love with a person, like you are supposed to be for your partner in life, then you should appreciate them without any makeup. And this is something that is overlooked, because the problem is when you put makeup, when people go into these virtual realities, like putting goggles on their head by going to the metaverse or taking recreational drugs, you know, they may feel better, but it's not the reality that we all share. And there is a problem with that, because, you know, you might look like Brad Pitt for your life, and you might be surrounded by celebrities and in that virtual reality. But if it's not the reality that you live in, you know, it's not as satisfactory, because you can never adapt to the actual reality that you live in. For example, you know, when Galileo Galilei argued that the Earth is not at the center of the universe, that was not very flattering to our ego. And a lot of people prefer to believe that, no, we are at the center of the world. And it got to a point where the theologians just put him in house arrest so nobody would listen to him. And today they would have canceled him on social media. And of course, that didn't change the fact that the Earth moves around the sun. So reality is not under any contract or obligation to flatter our ego. And we tend to forget about that. So we keep thinking that we are at the center of the world, that we are the smartest in the universe, that nothing like us was ever made, that we are the pinnacles of creation. And frankly, you know, these statements are probably wrong, because we now know that a substantial fraction of all the sun-like stars have a planet the size of the Earth, roughly the same separation. So the environment around us is not unique or special. And moreover, we know that humans came to exist, the human species, only a few million years ago. And that's just one part in 10,000 of the age of the universe, the Big Bang. So if you come to a cosmic play just at the end of the play, and you're not at the center of the stage, the play is not about you.
Another book that I've read in the last year that published a little bit more previously that, the title of your book, Extraterrestrial, kind of balances out another controversial book, Sapiens, which is a lot about history and storytelling and the human experience. The book discusses how the encounters between civilizations, such as Cortez and the Aztecs, was like an alien encounter. I mean, the civilizations were so different from each other at that point in time. Is there anything from the human history at large that we can learn to prepare us for Oumuamua's wager?
Well, interestingly, it was Stephen Hawking that argued that based on human history, we should be really careful of extraterrestrials, because, you know, if we look at what happened in South America when the Spanish came, you know, not much was left of those cultures that existed there. And so if we encounter, we might encounter a predator. Frankly, I don't agree with him. I think they are so much more advanced than we are if they arrive here that they wouldn't care about us. They wouldn't be threatened by us. And in fact, you know, it takes light about 50,000 years to traverse the Milky Way galaxy. So if you think 50,000 years ago, we were not that interesting. We were not distinguishable from nature. We lived in caves, and someone from a distance would think that we are just like apes or animals. And so if anyone sent a probe in our direction in the past tens of thousands of years, you know, it can't move faster than light, and they probably never had us in mind. Okay, so I don't think we have to worry about it. I don't think that there is a risk, because the way I think about us is like ants on the pavement. And if a biker comes by, the biker doesn't care much about the ants in the cracks of the pavement. We are not that significant. You know, once again, I think we tend to think that we are important and we would pose a threat to someone else, but I say very unlikely.
In your book, you talk about that frightening existential truth to people, the insignificance. And, you know, it's something that people spend a lot of time in therapy or meditation trying to struggle with. And in your book, you say we are transient structures that exist in the memory of other transient structures, and that is all. However, yet in how you're saying it there and now, you seem to find this like comfortingly pragmatic. Even in your book, you quote Rabbi Nachman to explain kind of a hopefulness in the perspective. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. Well, first thing is that I'm not particularly proud of my body, my brain, my existence, because I feel that I inherited it from my parents. Okay, just the way that you get a car from a dealer. You shouldn't be proud of a car, even though a lot of alpha males are proud driving cars very fast and so forth. You know, that's completely inappropriate because they didn't design the car. They didn't manufacture the car. They just got it from a dealer. So now they are proud of having it. That's not really an accomplishment, okay? Anyone that has enough money can buy that car. And so my point is, if we think about ourselves, you know, even when you think about yourself, you are not really responsible for designing your liver, your heart, your brain. So why should we be attached to ourselves more than to others? You know, like, it doesn't make sense to me. And a lot of the atrocities throughout human history were rooted in the human ego, when a group of people try to feel superior relative to other people. Or I see that a lot in academia. Jealousy is a very dominant element in academia, where people notice someone accomplishing something, they feel jealous about it, they try to bring it down. I say, why should you be attached to yourself more than to the other person? I mean, if another person succeeds, so be it. That's great. I don't feel that arrogance makes any sense, okay? And in that vein, I also, for humanity as a whole, I think we can learn more by finding others. We can learn from them. And I don't feel that we are unique or special. That's arrogance in my view. I think that the default should be there are others out there and they might be far more sophisticated than we are. That should be the default. However, my colleagues in academia, they regard that as an extraordinary claim. They say, we don't want to even discuss it until you bring extraordinary evidence that they exist. And I say, well, obviously, I will never be able to deliver extraordinary evidence if I don't have extraordinary funding. And so if you don't engage in the search for wonderful things, you will never discover them. And so the problem is really that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like many other things in life, you argue that something is extraordinary, you don't even look in that direction, and then you'd never see it. It's sort of like the ostrich metaphor. You put your head in the sand, or you raise enough dust in the air, and then you say, I don't see anything. And that boils down also to Fermi's paradox. Enrico Fermi, back in 1950, had a lunch at Los Alamos and argued, well, regarding extraterrestrials, where is everybody? And my point is, in order to find your neighbors, you have to look through your windows, and you better use a telescope. You can't just sit on the sofa and say, I don't see them around me right now.
Previously on this show, I've had Frank White, who is the author of The Overview Effect, and he's interviewed astronauts as a proxy for what's it going to be like in the future when many people have seen Earth from space and in space. How does that change the individuals and the community at large? And right now in the 2020s, you know, people who have the money are buying tickets to go kiss the Kármán line or spend a week up on the space station. Philosophically, how do you think the increased experience of the overview effect in the coming years will impact Oumuamua's wager?
Oh, I think as long as we collect more data, and I don't care if it's the government or it's the Galileo project that I lead, doesn't really matter who the messenger is, but as long as we take this path that was not taken, the road not taken, in the words of Robert Frost, that there will be some low-hanging fruit. We will learn more. And, you know, I don't have a prejudice. I just say we need to collect that data before we make a statement on whether we are alone. And this is an approach that was never tried. I mean, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence in the past 70 years was dedicated to looking for radio signals. And that was pioneered by Frank Drake, who passed away last year. And I think it was misguided because it was based on the fact that 70 years ago, we developed radio communication and we thought, oh, if we are transmitting radio signals, maybe they do as well. But that's a narrow-minded view to imagine that early in our technological development, we are using some communication method that this would be the one used by civilizations that are, you know, maybe billions of years ahead of us. I think an approach that is better than waiting for a phone call at home, which is pretty much what the radio search is, waiting for a phone call. A better approach is to check your mailbox and see if there are any packages that arrived in the mail, because even if the senders are dead by now, the packages will still be there. And that's the approach that I'm taking. And hopefully we'll find something. And I don't care who finds it, but I do think that will be a big revolution, the most significant revolution that humanity will have in the future, bigger than the AI revolution, because the AI revolution may be embedded in that, because, you know, if we have AI, they might have AI. And so we will learn from them.
Similarly, previously on this show, I had Rachel Raz, who produced the Space Torah documentary about Dr. Hoffman, who is a retired astronaut and is also a radio astronomer at MIT. And he brought with him a dreidel and a parchment, a Torah parchment with him in space. So I was wondering if you're ever to go out to space, either, you know, just into zero gravity or go take a picture of the next interstellar object, if you could, they could bring you up close, what objects would you bring with yourself?
Okay, I'll bring my body and I can tell you what my dream is. My dream is that something will go wrong and then my body will just be floating in space. Now, I will probably die shortly afterwards. So my ambition is not to die on Mars, the dream of Elon Musk. I hope to die in space. And the reason is that there is a chance that I will be kicked out of the solar system by a planet as a result. And then I will be floating in interstellar space between the stars. I will not be alive, but my body will continue on this journey. And then there is a chance that I will collide, my body will collide with another planet and will appear as a meteor. And there might be a scientist on that planet who is curious to examine this interstellar meteor. And that scientist will be, of course, ridiculed by colleagues and nevertheless will go and scoop the ocean floor and find my relics. And then that will be the greatest honor that I can imagine, of being recognized and remembered by another intelligent species on another planet with my remains presented in a local museum over there. So that's what I wish for. But before I get there, I need to go to space. And I hope that in the coming years, I will do that. I very much hope so.
I don't think I can have any more questions after that. It's a perfect place to wrap up right there. Your wish is there for interstellar travel should anything go wrong. Thank you so much for your time today, Professor Loeb. I really appreciate it. This was a fun conversation. I really enjoyed it. I hope you did too.
Thank you for having me. It was fun. Yes.
This episode of Space Midrash was directed by me, Jacob Sager, right here on planet Earth, and produced by Brand New Colors, LLC.